Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Anand Patel.
And I'm Naomi Sheldon.
And we're your hosts of The Pleasure Podcast. I'm a doctor specialising in sexual function.
And I'm a writer with an interest in the intimate.
We talk to guests to help us understand the relationship we have with our bodies when it comes to sex and intimacy.
It's a whole new kind of sex education for your owl.
Careful.
Pleasure. This week of The Pleasure Podcast, we welcome the award-winning comedian, actor and writer Richard Gadd. In 2016, he won the esteemed Edinburgh Comedy Award with Monkey See, Monkey Do, a raw personal account about his sexual assault. It was a performance which pushed the boundaries of comedy and which felt monumentally cathartic for its win. In 2019, his first solo theatre show, Baby Reindeer, was the talk of Edinburgh. In it, he relives his experience of being stalked by a woman with a dangerous obsession with him, about wrestling with his sexuality and trying to come to terms with his assault. It's a shocking, thrilling show.
We speak about the effects of growing up in an uber-masculine world where you thank God you're not gay and sex ed was devoid of condoms. He speaks about the sexual abuse and grooming which threw his relationship with sex out of orbit, and of the erectile dysfunction that followed, which destroyed relationships and his confidence.
Richard tells us how he's been able to approach sex and intimacy again, and how his deeply personal shows have been part of that healing process.
He describes what drives a person to make a show about their trauma, and what the effect is when you thought it might ruin you, but in fact launched you into a whole new dazzling chapter of your career.
The conversation does go to some darker places, as it does make reference to some upsetting themes.
I grew up in a place called Wormit, which is sort of just over the water from Dundee. Went to a state school. I think there were rougher state schools out there, but, you know, there was still a sort of heavy masculinity to the place, you know. And, you know, I've always been a bit of an anomaly in the sense, I'm strong Catholic background. So that coupled with the fact it was quite a fighty, sort of scrappy, sort of homophobic school. The fact that, you know, growing up in a generation where gay didn't really mean gay anymore. It meant uncool or lame or that's gay, this is gay, or gay this, gay that. My sexuality has moved on from heterosexuality. But when I grew up, going through adolescence, I definitely fancied girls and I was heterosexual and I was completely comfortable in that. And that was what I was. But I remember in the back of my mind, I wasn't a religious person, but I'd occasionally pray and I'd thank God for making me straight. So that in itself shows that you know, like from somewhere, whether it was from school, from whatever, there was like a seed of doubt, relief, whatever that made me sort of do that. But I remember I reckon I didn't doubt my sexuality till what happened to me, which I'm sure we'll get onto later. But I remember from a very young age how relieved I would be that I was dating and having successful sex with girls. But there was like a screaming into the air, like, thank you God.
Wow,
like
a real fear.
I mean, who were the main sort of masculine role models in your early life?
My dad was a masculine role model in the sense that I do come from... My dad is a masculine guy and utterly fearless and not afraid to argue with anyone. He isn't afraid of anyone and he isn't afraid of what people think. It's quite impressive. I actually find it quite impressive a lot of the time. I'm not going against the idea of a masculine... I think, you know, teaching masculinity and femininity to a kid is a good idea. I certainly remember growing up, you know, I would always get in fights. And I remember when I went to secondary school, knowing that it was a rough school, and my sister was 2 years above, and my sister was rough around the edges, and she certainly fell in with a troubled crowd and, you know, had her own upheavals. But she certainly painted to me that it's a rough place. You got to sort of be ready for it. And I remember thinking, well, I've got to get in a fight on day one so people leave me alone. I know that's like a sort of prison, like sort of mentality. You know, looking back on it, what an utterly absurd, like, notion. But I remember thinking, and I went all the way through school thinking, how do I get in a fight? Starting fights, but people being like, oh, the day one, who is this intense guy? You know, and like sort of, you know, and then getting all the way through the, I haven't had a fight yet. And then on the bus back home, because it was only a 20-minute, maybe even half an hour bus to school from where I lived, getting in a fight on the bus and finally sort of getting in a fight on a bus. And just being like, well, thank God I managed to get it. You know, people did leave me alone, but I think even if you, not so much even the environment, I mean, even if you look at fables growing up, even fairy tales, the prince rescues the princess, you know, it all seeps into your subconscious. You know, it's not from both genders. You know, women are supposed to be feminine and a product of male gaze and desires, and men are supposed to be tough and the saviors and the providers. And I don't think any of it's particularly helpful, but I think, you know, it's everywhere growing up. Even sex education in schools, primary schools, there certainly wasn't any gay teachings when I was younger. You know,
it was. What was your experience of sex ed at school?
I remember, like, state school education, we didn't even have the condoms to put on the fake penises. I mean, it was just...
So you just had like, a sort of...
A bunch of
erect penises.
I think there was one, and if I remember, Tom Cliff put it on. And, you know, I do remember it was a joke looking back. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it was... I hope it's a lot better now. I'm sceptical because I know that there's been all this protest in Birmingham about not wanting kids to learn sort of homosexual sex education, if that makes sense. But, yeah, it was a joke. And I reckon, all that systemic sort of heteronormative thinking has done phenomenal damage probably to people growing up. You know, like if you're sitting in a classroom, and I wasn't at the stage because I know people say, well, it's latent. You surely look back on a time in your life where you looked over the change rooms and saw some guy's ass, thought, fancy a bit of that. Nope, not going to go there. I mean, I can. I mean, there was various instances in my life, you know, and I would say, but I don't remember that latent thing. So when I was younger, I was straight. But imagine if there was a kid that, you know, is already feeling awkward and already having these confusing feelings, and then they're teaching them sex and nothing comes in about the stuff they're feeling, and then they, like, no lesbian education, no gay education.
Welcome to my early life.
Well, exactly. Then you're going to leave that classroom thinking, need to be straight, need to figure out how to put my penis in it. But and it's just adding to the repression, you know. A lot of the problem, I think, coming back to the point of heteronormativity and masculinity, is actually a systemic problem more than anything.
You said you were having quite successful romantic relationships, sex anyway, with, with women from a young age, well, as you were growing up.
Yeah.
When you say successful, what does that mean?
Well, Barry White was playing in the background. Well, successful, it's kind of weird. It makes it sound like a sort of essay. It makes it sound like, you know, like some sort of
A
exam.
Yeah. Sexual activity.
I was a horny teenager and I was successfully horny, and we were a vibrant school. Like, I remember, like, you know, I lost my virginity young. And I remember thinking I was late. And I lost my virginity at 14. And I remember thinking that I was late to the party. Like, that's how at it we were. I mean, there were kids having sex with each other when they were like 12, like 13. I remember, like, feeling a pressure to lose my virginity, like a pressure. And I lost it, I think, a few weeks before I turned 15, I remember. And thinking, like, even though virginity's 16, I had to lose it before 16, but I really have to lose it soon because I was starting to wear the stench of virginity on me. I look back and it's ridiculous. I look at 14-year-olds now, I'm like, they shouldn't be having sex.
Children.
Like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. But, you know, it was a school where sex was at the forefront of the conversation, and I had great girlfriends at school, and through school I... you know, relationship hopped, and it was fine. I never had any insecurities around sex. If anything, it was something I massively looked forward to at the time. And now I've got a lot more hang-ups than I do back then.
What hang-ups do you think you've got now?
I think I find intimacy quite hard now. You know, every podcast in the back of my mind, there's this, like, are we just waiting to drop the clangor of sexual abuse? Like, do you see what I mean? So maybe if I just say that happened to me. You know, and it didn't happen to me when I was, like, young. It happened in sort of late, like, I was still young. Like, the grooming period happened over a period of time. But, you know, that threw my relationship to sex out of whack. A lot of shame. A lot of shame that I was older and how could I be so naive. A lot of shame the fact that I was, you know, I had a lot of Catholic guilt. Like, I was such a heterosexual and I had loads of sex. And was this, like, some kind of punishment? Like, you know, there was lots of thoughts going through my head. I'm not a man anymore. You know, all this kind of stuff. And I carried that around for years and it almost killed me. Like, and I was close to that, you know. And so my relationship to sex shifted almost overnight because I remember my girlfriend at the time, Josephine, who never really knew anything I was going through. It must have been a nightmare for her because one night it's like, you know, getting groomed, and especially when you're entering the industry, and and then something like that happens, sudden shock. It's like your whole retrospective. Oh, if that's so, it seems so obvious now. Yeah. Like the whole process.
That's the challenging thing about grooming, though, isn't it? It's so insidious.
Yeah,
it's sort of just a sort of a creeping slowness about it, and it sort of covers everything that's going on.
Yes.
And you are sold a story, and sometimes quite happy to believe that story. It's really nice to hear that you're fabulous or beautiful, yeah, or talented, or you know, all of these things.
And when drugs are on tap and all this kind of stuff.
And I can imagine that that's a real environment where you would be sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and a bit, you know, gosh, I'm being drawn into this exciting world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's some of the beauty of youth, actually. The fact that you can be innocent and wide-eyed and have joy in this and go, oh, isn't this brilliant?
Yeah.
Look at this experience that I'm having. Look, I've got someone who's looking after me or looking out for me or giving me these experiences. Lucky me. And it's only in, you know, with the retrospectoscope, you kind of look back and go, fucking hell, I was being incredibly carefully manipulated and targeted.
Yes, 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 exactly. And it was like my life changed in a moment. I actually felt like a feeling in my brain, almost like my synapses like shifted, and like a feeling in my chest, like a tightness that didn't really go for years and years and years. And I remember going back to my girlfriend and you know, there were a lot of, the way to do it was the loads of drugs involved over a long period of time, and getting used to being around someone on drugs and, you know, building up a certain sense of trust, which is then taken away from you. Mm. You know, I went back to my girlfriend at the time, Josephine, and who you know, like, and I wasn't going to say anything, like, not in a million years was I going to tell her what happened. But I remember that night, I think she was annoyed at me that I'd been like away for like 3 days on drugs and you know, not being in touch. So she was sort of annoyed at me, you know, which is fine. But also I do remember, like, not that night, but I think the next morning she tried to have sex with me, and I felt so awful that, not because of her, but just the idea of my body and intimacy and not wanting that and feeling like I was defiled and not wanting anywhere near me. And it, that then started a sort of long period of sort of erectile dysfunction, really. And, you know, I don't think we were meant to be together. I think she'd probably agree that. But I certainly think that breakup was sped up by the fact that I was sexually underperforming and not telling her why, and her thinking it was because of her. And, you know, I hope she understands now where that all came from. But, like, I think I was borderline impotent for about nine months following it. I didn't have a sexual thought in my head or energy. I literally thought it was taken away from me.
Stolen.
And I went from being almost empowered by my heterosexuality to being full of doubt and almost asexual. It was a crazy shift. It really was.
You mentioned in an article, I think, in Refinery 29, mm-hmm. about feeling really detached from your body. Really
massively.
And that it sort of kind of existed as a sidebar to you.
Yeah, yeah. I took no pleasure from anything. And I would load up porn, all different types within the realms of legality, obviously. And nothing was doing anything for me. It's weird because when you go through a traumatic event, you know, I've had a lot of therapy since then, you know, trauma, it's kind of weird because your body and your brain works very hard trying to make you forget it. So like when you go back through it, sometimes it's like, you know, there's like graffiti under a wall and you're sort of wiping the wall away, trying to like remember it all. But it was a terrible period of time. Yeah, I certainly felt like my sort of body wasn't mine anymore. I almost didn't want it to be. I was just quite a happy teenager. You know, I was always anxious and overthought and all that kind of stuff. But I was a happy teenager and happy but
mildly neurotic, which is quite the state of a lot of teenagers.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I always felt like, you know, my anger at the world and my anger at the situations and my anger at myself all happened like later, like when I was after all this event. And I felt like I was almost like an angry teenager in my 20s. I felt so vulnerable that I remember shaving my head bald. I grew my facial hair. I looked like, I'll show you a photo after. I looked like a nutcase. I would be on a bus on the upper deck. And, you know, when it's all busy on an upper deck and people aren't allowed to stand on an upper deck, there'd be a seat next to me and people would come up, look around the bus, and then just walk back downstairs, you know, because they wouldn't want to sit next to me because I made myself look aggressive. I felt very vulnerable with eye contact, like people knew what happened every time I looked into their eyes. But I wouldn't want that to beat me. So I'd be on the tube almost like staring people out, being like, what the fuck do you want?
It's interesting because you've got quite a strong brow. It's quite a, you know, it's a very strong, yeah. in a man, it's a very, it's a good feature. So you've got quite a strong brow. So I imagine that with very strong direct eye contact is actually very challenging to people.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And like, I wanted to fight. I sort of wanted to get the shit kicked out of me. I never self-harmed, but I felt like I wanted to. I felt so like the pain in me was so deep and so overwhelming that I really felt the urge to, but I thought, like, that's ridiculous, like, don't. But I used to think when I was growing up, you know, when kids were doing it, like, I didn't understand what that impulse was. Like, what is that? Like, where does that come from? I remember feeling like it was only when I'd gone through that and that hate and disregard for my body and all that stuff where I actually thought, oh, I can almost see the relief that you get from something like that. Very dark.
So I know you mentioned sort of in the Rich Wilson podcast, you're talking about running.
Yes,
this
yes.
stage, and you mentioned actually this photograph, which I think in that podcast.
Yeah,
and you talk about how you were running, I don't know, 20 kilometers or 20 miles or something.
I'd run obsessively. Yeah, just so I could sleep. I still feel it even now as I'm sitting here. My knees hurt, my ankles hurt. I did myself phenomenal damage during that period of time. It was horrendous. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, and I have many.
May I just ask about your coping strategies that you used? I mean, clearly, because if we, for example, have had relatively uneventful, happy-go-lucky childhoods, we perhaps haven't come across the situations whereby we can learn coping strategies for negative events. I'm not that I'm saying that all childhoods should have something bad happen within them to be able to learn that, but some people don't necessarily get that modelling from their parents. You know, they're not necessarily taught how, you know, psychologically, how would you deal with a difficult situation? If you're trying to be a masculine person and put that, project that out there, often that sort of carapace is quite fragile and brittle.
Yeah.
So, for example, if, you know, one knock on it and it shatters, a significant knock, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely.
And it shatters. And so for you, it sounds like, you know, you'd had a relatively happy-go-lucky childhood, which was based in masculinity.
Yeah, 100%.
And you were projecting that because you went to school and you were picking a fight and you were having sex with loads of girls and it all sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
And then you have this horrendous event happen to you, which would shatter anyone's, you know, ecosystem, psychological or physical. So, you know, you've got this ecosystem that gets shattered and then you have to pick up the pieces. And psychologically, you know, if I may ask, you know, emotionally that must have been like a vortex, an absolute maelstrom. Whilst at the same time you're trying to forget things, you have, you know, you must have had, you know, whooshes of adrenaline, you know, huge amounts of cortisol, all these hormones in your body that are very stress related, powering through you.
Yeah.
Whilst you're trying to forget.
Yeah.
Just really intrigued about how you managed the emotions you experienced.
I guess I didn't. I could never sleep, so I'd run until I, you know, could sleep, really. And I still then I wouldn't really sleep. I would ridicule myself for being this cliche of depression. You know, like, I would hate the mornings are the hardest, but the mornings were the hardest. And I would make sure I got up before the sun was in the air because I didn't want to be awake in the sort of cold light of day. I wanted the calm of the night to bring me into the day. So I was running all night, you know, miles and miles, really until I felt like I couldn't handle it anymore. Sometimes I could time it so I'd make it back to the house just for that period. At other times I'd just run and run, have my Oster in my pocket, jump on the tube, or go all the way back. But I did not have any coping strategies. And also I had this attitude of I knew I needed to slow down. I knew I needed to maybe go back home, have a bit of parental love or whatever. I knew I needed to stop, but I didn't want it to win what had happened. I didn't want it to defeat me and ruin my lust for life, which, you know, I came to London for a reason because I love doing what I do and I didn't want it to beat that. So I had this thing where, like, I'm not letting it win. And I think that was perhaps the biggest problem at all. I persevered and persevered and I got through it. But, you know, I wasn't easy on myself for one second. I carried on trying to make it during this whole period of time, which was probably quite unhealthy in itself. So I didn't have any coping strategies. My running was my coping strategy, but it became addictive and problematic. And like I say, my knees and my ankles are in a state, you know, these days. And I'm 30 and, you know, people's bodies start to get a bit tired when about 35 is usually when your body starts to go down the other way. You're a doctor, you probably know that. Is that
well,
right?
Well, I'm 43, so I'm now considering which parts of me okay, go the other way. Well,
I've got a year to go before I'm done.
Like I say, the footballer's prime is 27, really. But then they start to sort of slow down from 30 sort of onwards. Then 35 is sort of retirement. I feel like my knees have been like agony since I was like 26. Like prime. So that's how much sort of damage I've done to them.
I was wondering, you said after it took you about 9 months of feeling very disassociated from your body.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering how you began to come alive again physically?
I mean, with difficulty, with people you trust. You know, I had a lot of small, very intense, short relationships with people during that time, and who were understanding of it, and it almost felt like losing my virginity again. But rather than that sort of like adolescent excitement, it was like nervousness of myself and getting it wrong. And you know, it was slowly but surely. I ran away from sex for a very long time. So yeah, it was. It took a while.
Did you think about, I mean, obviously my special interest is sexual dysfunction, so I've probably got quite a skewed view of the world. But did you think at any time, perhaps I need to go and see my doctor, or I need to see a sexual therapist or something like that?
I've been to a lot of therapy. You know, I've done a lot of therapy, and I did go to my doctor. When I first went to the doctor, I do remember saying, look, I'm really struggling right now, breaking down, crying. This is quite shortly after the incident itself, and I do remember she sort of rattled off a list of questions, and first was like, have you done psychedelic drugs recently? And I remember being like, yeah. And one of them was like, have you been like inappropriately touched or abused, or sexually abused recently? And I remember it was like the first like two questions, like, yeah. They really hit me in the gut with how accurate they sort of were. And, you know, I waited 9 months maybe for NHS. And then I was sent to CBT because, you know, I wasn't being honest with anyone. So they felt I was just suffering from anxiety. And CBT is sort of like, let's draw a line under the past and learn how to cope in the present. And I didn't feel like I could just draw a line under the past, really. And I think on about session 8 or 9 of the 10 sessions I got, I said, look, I'm going to tell you something now. And then I was passed around from department to department and moved to other sort of charities outside. And I've done a lot of therapy. I think therapy can be good. You know, I think, you know, my advice to anyone who's thinking of going is sometimes you can like almost lie to yourself and the therapist in therapy, because you almost want to feel a sense of momentum, like things are getting better because you've gone. My advice is that I've wasted hours of therapy just trying to convince myself that I was making progress. I've learned now that the trick, because it is all confidential anyway, is to just stay being honest, you know. And I think once I finally was honest in a room, it sort of got a bit better.
It's particularly hard because you are building a relationship with that therapist, aren't you? And if you have a desire to not be judged, or a desire to be liked, or whatever it is, then you can actually try and play this game where you want them to like you, and therefore you don't want to say things that they might judge.
I remember putting up a tweet saying, I need to get a therapist to explain why I keep lying to my current therapist.
I wonder now what intimacy can, what does, or could look like for you. And I don't mean just sex. I guess I mean, yeah, intimacy, really.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know at this point. I've got a lot better. I've got a partner who's amazing and understands and is patient. But I'm intimate with loads of people emotionally, you know, and like friends and family, and you know, like I have intimacy in my life in that respect. But you know, sexual intimacy, you know, it can take I'm getting there, but there's still work to do.
Moving forward, moving on, is a really difficult thing to judge. You know, you were saying that, you know, where are you with intimacy and trust? Well, I don't know, and absolutely, that seems absolutely fine. You know, how could you know 100% now?
Yes.
And yeah, even in 20 years, you might not necessarily be 100% with the answer for that, but one hopes with time and healing, etc., that would get sort of better.
Yes, yeah.
Want of a less facile word.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has, you know, it has. I'm almost there. It's, you know, I think we're going through a big cultural conversation now about sex and sexuality and fluidity and all these kinds of things, and we're stopping to think about things as being so binary, and everything's becoming a bit looser and a bit more, you know. But sometimes I can sometimes feel that breeds a little bit more confusion, because it's almost, it does, it's great in saying that, you know, it's all right to be confused, but at the same time, there's so much options and so many different things and so many different ways we're viewing sex now, and There's even a, you might know the answer, well, what's it called when you're, now that people think that people are sometimes just attracted to the person and not the gender, what's that called again?
To their brain. Remember, we talked about
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean?
Sapiosexual.
Well, that must
to
be
intelligence.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that's what I am, but, you know, there's so many, like, scientists and so many experts and all that. Everything's shifting and we're all thinking about things in different ways, but I feel like I'm standing in the middle of a whirlpool of a conversation being like, where does it start and where does it end?
Yeah.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Do you feel you're carrying that period of your life around with you in your body all the time?
I think it gets easier and easier day by day. And I think, like, you know, I've worked so hard to sort of make it a part of my life in a positive way. I work for a sexual abuse charity now. I've obviously done shows about it and spoken about it at length.
So I was just really interested on that point, doing the shows, because you are doing... running on a treadmill.
Yes, this is Monkey See, Monkey Do.
So, yes,
yeah.
Monkey See, Monkey Do. You're running on a treadmill, reliving your abusive experience about being a runner who's trying to run away from their abusive experience.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah. That's exactly what it was, yeah.
And it sounds utterly exhausting.
Yeah, it was, and that was a whole other thing. I just remember, like, when I was running in this period of hell And I just remember just this odd, like, light bulb in the distance, like a blinking sort of star. It was just like, maybe do a show. No, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. But every time that, like, star would come slightly bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think it got to a point where, like, I was exhausted and of doing these comedy shows that was that sort of removed from what I was actually going through. And it was becoming harder and harder to put on this facade. So I thought either I quit and take some TLC and, you know, go back home and take a rest, or I find a way of fusing my work and my ambition with what happened to me, because that I felt like it was one or the other. The irony was, I thought it would ruin me, that show. I thought it was going to be derided and absurd. And I mean, I always felt like we have like a monkey, that monkey brain, that sort of idea is where the show sort of came from. And I felt like, you know, as the idea that we are monkeys and we still react through fear-based sort of primal instincts about things, but we've become sort of human beings and very intellectualized, so we're constantly jarring between our, like, primal instincts and our ability to intellectualize. And I really felt like during that whole period of time I'd lost myself to, like, my base primal instincts. And, like, I was just full of anger and hate and upset, and there was never any sort of respite. It was just that. And that's what the show was. I was on a treadmill running away from the monkey on the projector screen and voices in my head and training for the man's competition. I mean, it was absurd. And then I played my therapy records, you know, and I had chins, like, miming along to them with little hats on. And, you know, the whole thing was mental. And I was like, this is going to be a long month. And I remember thinking, as I got to Edinburgh, I did a preview in London that was a disaster. And I went to Edinburgh and I remember thinking, I just got to get through this. Like, you know, I just got to get to the end.
Can I just ask, why? I just don't get the idea of putting yourself through, but you know, you've had a disastrous experience, you've then had a disastrous first show, and then you know, I don't know if I would have the psychological chutzpah to kind of go, I'm still going to keep going.
Yeah, I had no choice, really. I had no choice. This really was my last option, to try and make a go of it still whilst living with this. It was my last option. And if it had failed, I don't know what I would have done. I had told myself I'd do it, and I didn't want to stop, and no matter what. And then for me to go from, like, we went to Edinburgh and we teched the show, and, you know, I'd employed, like, a group of us on the show. And I remember we did this really sort of disgruntled tech where everything was going wrong and people were argumentative, and it was just awful. And I remember we all sat down and we had a conversation where, you know, we all expressed very honestly that we were very worried about what was to come. And I was cracking up. And I remember someone in the team saying, look, you know, you just got to hope you'll get a few fours, you know, threes are fine. You know, I doubt this is going to get twos and ones, but like threes and fours, that's good. Like, you know, this is never going to win the Comedy Awards. I remember somebody said, and then it fucking won the Comedy Award about four weeks later. I mean, it was the most astonishing. We sat in that tech and I thought, like, it could be the biggest chance of sort of mass suicide. There's seven people in a room thinking it's not worth it, let's just end it now, and at least we'll have an Edinburgh story of some kind. For how the month panned out, I sort of couldn't believe it.
Had a lot of your friends or family, was this the first time that they'd heard your story?
My mum obviously knew, but I had to phone my dad before Edinburgh and sort of tell him.
May I ask how he took that?
He took it very well. I was very impressed, and I always worried about what he'd think, and he was brilliant about it. And he has sort of been brilliant about it. And I think there's part of him that doesn't want to know, like, the details, but knows that it's happened. And then it was sort of cards on the table. You know, I play on a football team. The irony of all of this stuff and you know, being a very emotional guy. And I know, like, we shouldn't think in terms of, like, structures, but you know, I do. I am obsessed, like, still with masculine forms, like MMA and football. I those are my two biggest passions in life from a sort of hobby watching point of view. Yeah. And I played on a football team in London, and they were a big making me doubt, because, you know, Sunday football is still, not so much anymore, but still to this day, a little bit homophobic, a little bit, you know, a little bit rough around the edges. I was really worried what they'd think.
I mean, no Premiership footballers come out as gay, have
Well,
they?
exactly. And I really worried what they'd think. And I remember the captain came along in Edinburgh, and I remember he came along, and I remember thinking, do I try and find a way of him not getting in? Like, and I remember just thinking, do I lock the doors and do I stop him coming, or do I say, because it was by that point it was like packed out, and you get texts of mates being like, can you squeeze me in the back door? And I do it, and I thought, well, how can I say to him, come at a time when he won't get in, you know? And then I thought, oh, you know, like, what's the point in hiding anymore? And I remember taking him along to the show, and he texted me afterwards being like, tonight made me, I'm going to get emotional. He was like, tonight made me proud to be your mate. And I just remember being like, why was I so worried, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, the football team have been, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always just remember, you know, sometimes I was like, what was I all so scared about? But hey-ho.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a crazy month. I'll never forget it. It was the best period of my life. And, you know, sometimes you have to go through the furnace to sort of come out the other side, you know?
And then, well, I suppose it was just before this period, before you put the show up, that you met who would then become your stalker.
Yes. Basically, I worked in a bar for a long period of time when I first moved to London, and a customer came in, you know, that I showed a bit of kindness to, and she became sort of slowly infatuated with me. And I knew she was sort of, she started coming to the pub more and more. I knew it was for me. I knew that she was coming in to see me. But because it was a pub in a public place, I could deal with it. It started to become really intense. It started to, like, get worse and worse. She started to sort of talk at me all shift and would interfere with the customers I was serving. And, you know, at the start, I was wrong, because, like, I knew she was unwell, and I knew that she was building up an infatuation. And I did sort of egg it on a bit. That was the culture of the pub. I'm very ashamed of that. Again, trapped in that masculine environment and actually giving in to these sort of reckless impulses, which are immoral. And I speak about that in the play. I did a lot to make the situation worse. And in fact, the tagline we've always used is, where did my morality stop and hers begin? And something like that. Yeah. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was at the pub, and I could cope with it But then it started to spill out into my life. You know, I was doing gigs and shows and she was turning up and following me home. And it got to the point where she obtained my email address and it really, over a number of years, ballooned into an impossible situation. I had to move house. I quit the job. And it was amazing, the skill, in a way, of her ability to always find me and get in amongst it. She was pestering comedians I was tagged in tweet with. She was pestering my family. It got to a point where it was impossible. And it was funny enough, when I won the comedy award and I started to say, look, I'm not straight anymore. What I am is sexually confused. I have had experiences with men and women. I don't know where I am. That was sort of what the show was saying. She had me, because I'd been behaving in such a masculine way, and I think because I do have a deep voice and I perhaps give off a masculine vibe, she really did email me like I was some sort of like epitome of sort of masculinity. And me doing the show and coming clean about all this stuff drove her insane, because it was like I'd been leading her on for such a long period of time. And she really flipped her lid, and her love for me and her passion and her obsession with following me around turned into furious anger and harassment and threats and violence and all kinds of things. And then around about this time, she got my number. So I just won the Edinburgh Comedy Award. I went on holiday and I sent an out-of-office reply. And even though I blocked her email address, for some reason, it rebounded to her. Almost like the out-of-office doesn't take notice of the blocking of the email address. So it sent my number back to her. And I got back, having won the Perry Award. I switched my phone off for a full, like, 10 days while I was away, because I'd never done that. I'd never treated myself to something like that. And I turned it on, and I had, like, 50 voicemails, and I thought, oh, this will be friends and family, and this will be people saying congratulations, and this is going to be great. And I remember, like, having a shower, cooking, like, a meal or whatever, and sitting down and getting ready to listen to them all. Like, who's left me a congratulations message? Welcome to your voicemail. And then I hear her voice, and I'm like, she's got my number. And she's filled it up, and she never hung up. She'd fill up, you know, you get about 20 minutes per voicemail, and she'd fill it right up.
And you'd listen to all of it?
Yeah, and it would cut her off. And then she'd phone back, and she'd fill it up. She filled up my entire inbox in the space of 2 days. And I calculated that it's like 50 messages at 20 minutes in 2 days. And so she was on the phone to me for the majority of 2 days, was basically what it was. And that was when it got really bad, because she was hitting me on all angles. And I didn't, again, that stubborn thing, I wasn't going to let the sexual abuse win. I wasn't going to let her win. I wasn't going to change my number. I wasn't going to change my email address. I wasn't going to alter my behavior. She needed to alter her behavior around me as the criminal, as the person who's committing the crime. But it took ages to get the situation dealt with. It took ages. And even when it was dealt with, there were still bits of it that were ongoing. I can't say much, but even though I did go down a legal route and the police did take their sweet ass time dealing with the situation, when I did get it legally dealt with, she still was pestering the pub. She was still pestering other people. She still made it known to theatres I was playing in. She still sent letters, and you know, and it did go on for a very long time. And it was such an awful experience, and one that I felt I had such little help to deal with from a legal point of view or a social point of view, that I thought, well, I should probably do a show about this now, you know, and show people just how fucking difficult it is.
It felt like there was this interesting duality going on, which you touched on in the show. It's fascinating, really, how she both simultaneously supported your masculinity, made you feel that you were the man that you'd sort of grown up wanting to be.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, being stalked by this woman, not being taken necessarily that seriously immediately by the police.
Yeah, yeah.
And feeling very threatened by her. Yeah. And yet still being this tough guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
That there's this both this building up and ripping down simultaneously.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to think like there was a reason she came into my life at the point that she did, you know, quite shortly after I was sexually abused. Like almost like, you know, again, I don't believe in God, but sometimes like, you know, you wonder about the mysteries of the world and life and whether there is something more. And I just remember thinking, like, there's a reason that when my confidence is so low and my insecurity is so low, that this woman turns up who's unadulterated, unchanneled, love and compliments and thinks I'm the manliest man on the planet and sits at the bar fueling my ego.
She groomed you too.
Well, yeah, in a way. But also I remember, like, just thinking, like, oh God, this guy's had it tough and God's going to fax a bit of love through, but it gets jammed, you know, in the fax, you know, and oh shit. And it sort of sends my way, but she is like unadulterated love, but because it's been jammed in the fax.
It's been warped.
It's been warped and it's slightly wrong.
It's obsession.
Do you know what I mean? And it was, I always thought it was so strange, like, especially when like I won the Edinburgh Comedy Awards, and I really felt like That was such a symbol of me getting my strength back, that literally, as I expunged the demons of one person, she just grabs the baton and starts running with it instead. You know,
you talked about it in the show. You speak as if it were a manifestation of this bad shit that has not necessarily been all exhumed or dealt with.
Yeah, I think
so,
yeah.
And transformed in another way and pushed on again.
Yes, yeah. I think so. I think there's loads of theories I have, and I think I try and throw a bunch of them out. I sometimes question whether she was sort of my screaming subconscious. Do you know what I mean? Like this last bastion of who I was trying to be, and this last symbol of why I need to stop trying to be this person.
How difficult that it makes one look inwards as opposed to feel like this is no fault of my own. This is, I know you make it very clear. In fact, you put quite a lot of importance on making sure the narrative is not one-sided, and that it's not a victim narrative in any way, as you say. You have a very balanced viewpoint.
I mean, I never wanted it to be I could have easily made myself out to be perfect and been like, I offered her a cup of tea and, oh my God, she ruined my life, look at that. But you know, I didn't behave well. And I think, you know, in this day and age, there's a lot of pressure and, you know, there's a lot of outrage. I really felt the pressure of that right in the show. And I really think I did a few drafts that were kowtowing to the outrage culture that we now live in, and where I just painted myself as the perfect victim, and then every third sentence I was sort of justifying while I was telling the story, you know. And eventually I realized that this did happen to me and I didn't behave perfect, and why am I bothering to sort of hide that?
And it's been hugely successful. Another hugely successful show. You've just had it announced today that you're going to be going to Ambassador's Theatre this year.
Ambassador's Theatre in the West End,
New York.
Yeah, and then New York.
I was wondering what it feels like to have two shows that deal with two very tough periods of your life so lauded.
Well, I think it helps, you know, like that they've been success, because not only have the shows, I've learned to sort of understand everything a bit more through doing the shows and through writing it and trying to understand it. The fact that they've touched people and made, especially Monkey Monkey Do, that made people understand their own sexual abuse and all this kind of stuff, it just makes you realise that it was the right decision and that you've come a long way. And if people like it, then there's a sort of validation that it was all okay, that you went through all this stuff. And I don't know, it means a great deal to me that they've been as well received as they have.
It really feels like you're putting literally your heart out there.
Yeah, and
and you've been scarred, but actually the scars are still fresh and they exist as part of you.
Yeah.
But you're giving it all there, and you're with the possibility you could receive yet more scars rather than healing.
Yeah, exactly. It's tough. You know, Monkey Monkey Do, I felt like I kept it in for so long that I was nervous but ready to speak about this. Like, no more hiding. With Baby Reindeer, the fact that it was sort of still ongoing, the fact that, you know, I explore my sexuality in it, which is still, you know, something I grapple with and question a lot. You know, a lot's made of the LGBT+, you know, that the big long alphabet, and there's a lot of cynicism and sneering, which I don't agree with. Mm. But the Q, you know, the questioning, you know, that was probably the first time that I actually felt, oh yeah, that is something that I do, like, day to day. I am a questioner, and that's how I currently am. But in the show, there is still that questioning element, and there is still, like, facets of Baby Reindeer that I feel uncomfortable with, like my own negative behaviour and the sexuality element and the times I was cruel. And
can I just ask about the sexuality bit?
Yeah.
Just what's the bit that gives you challenge? Is it the fact that your masculine sort of hyper image is being challenged by it?
Well, or? I talk about dating a trans woman in Baby Reindeer, and I talk about my discomfort about that, you know. And I really regret that. And I put it out to an audience every night and saying, look, I was in a relationship with someone that I was ashamed of. I was ashamed of myself and that part of myself, but it manifested in being ashamed of someone else. And I don't know, like, I really regret that and kick myself for that. I can forgive myself due to entrenched masculinity and all that stuff growing up. I can sort of forgive myself. But what I grapple with Baby Reindeer is that I don't think I was quite ready to face how guilty I feel about the whole thing. Yeah, it does take it out of me. I do find it difficult. Yeah.
I was wondering, because you mentioned how doing the shows help you deal with certain periods of your life and issues and questions. it's interesting. I suppose I'm talking from the perspective of someone who's written a very autobiographical show, and I'm in the middle of writing another one at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes how much during the writing of it, it can be very therapeutic, and, well, not to be too cliched about it, but it can be. And you're grappling with things and you're putting it out to the world and saying, I mean, I don't know if this is you, but it's certainly me. This is me. Do you feel this? Do you have this? Am I reaching anyone?
Yeah.
Please stand up, call out.
Yeah, that is what it's like.
But also, after a while, I start to feel like I don't own it so much. Sometimes I start to feel like I'm handing it over to the art form now or to the audience.
Yeah, which can feel good. I think I agree with all of that. And I think I did eventually learn to do that with Monkey See Monkey Do. I think that's part of the healing process. You learn to distance yourself from it. And that is art is catharsis, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm maybe waiting for that threshold to come with Baby Reindeer where, right, I've left that on stage now, I'm at peace with it. And I think it will come. It came with Monkey See Monkey Do after a long time. Yeah. You know, that wasn't easy, you know. But by the end, I felt it was a lot easier. And I think that's true. And I think that can be quite helpful, actually.
You can follow Richard on social media at Mr. Richard Gadd for more information on his shows and upcoming dates. Thank you for listening to The Pleasure Podcast.
If you enjoy this, do share, review and subscribe on iTunes.
It really does help other people find us and helps to give the series a boost. Please do give us 5 stars.
Thank you to Acast for hosting us.
Matt Peaver for editing us. Ollie Birch for the music.
Gilad Visotsky for the graphics.
Join us next time when we interview another guest for their insights on the relationship we have to our bodies, sex, and of course, pleasure.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.